Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now our guest is a veteran with a tremendous amount of experience, and he's also written some books, including Margin of Victory, Five Battles That Changed the Face of Modern War. His name is Douglas McGregor. His website is douglasmcgregor.com. McGregor is spelled M-A-G-R-E-G-O-R. Mr. McGregor, thank you so much for joining us, Sir Colonel McGregor. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for thinking of me.
Sure. We're going to focus on, if we could, the borders and the conflict related to the borders and immigration and so forth, and just basically our identity as Americans and so forth. But let's talk a little bit about your own personal background, and especially this new book, that Margin of Victory, that's gotten a lot of attention.
Well, first of all, let me tell your listeners that I served 28 years in the regular Army. And during that time frame, I was on many borders. I spent almost 6 years of my military career on the Czechoslovak and East German borders before the Soviet state system collapsed. So I have a lot of experience with securing borders. And it's also important for your listeners to know that the United States Army, that is the regular Army, was actually on the Mexican border, defending it from 1846 until 1948. So we have a long history of placing American military power along the Rio Grande to protect the United States. And every single senior officer of the Second World War saw extensive service on the Mexican border in the 1920s and 30s.
Wow. Interesting. All right, and tell us a little about your book, Margin of Victory.
Well, Margin of Victory, I think, would be interesting to people because it looks at five battles and five wars between 1914 and 1991. And it asks the question, what produces success? How do military establishments adapt to new conditions? And what's the right way to do that? The way to do it, of course, is to think ahead of time, but very few people do it. And the second important lesson is that almost everybody who starts these wars expects them to be short and decisive and minimally damaging. And we know the rest of the story. All of the wars turn out to last much longer than anyone would like, mm-hmm. cause infinitely more damage than anybody anticipated. And I think that's probably the single most important lesson, that if you don't have to fight, if you're not compelled to fight, then don't.
Mm. Wow. So a peace through strength, but don't go out there and cause a war. I did a little background check on some of those battles that you mentioned, the five battles that changed the face of modern war. Maybe you could even list those for us, but let me just say this as a setup. I had looked up the Battle of Belorussia, which I have to admit I wasn't really that familiar with, 1944. On the one hand, it was listed as a Soviet victory, and on the other hand, it was saying that they lost 700,000 soldiers or men in that particular conflict. So it sounds like a Pyrrhic victory, so to speak. But what were the five battles?
Well, in connection with the third that you're mentioning, which was the destruction of Germany's Army Group Center, the truth is that the Soviets lied about the numbers of casualties that they sustained during the Second World War and the numbers of dead. They said 20 million, and in reality, almost 40 million people died inside the Soviet Union, and nearly 15 million Soviet soldiers.
Oh.
There are some figures now suggesting even larger losses. And that was a function of the way the Soviets fought the war. We can talk about that later on, but the Germans obviously took far fewer losses, but ultimately they lost because of a multi-front situation. But the five battles begins in 1914 with the British Expeditionary Force fighting the Germans in a town called Mons in August of 1914. And then we move from that to the Japanese invasion of China and the Battle of Shanghai. Then we go on to look at the battle that you mentioned before in Belorussia or White Russia. Then we look at the Egyptians and the Israelis in 1973. And then finally we end on Desert Storm and the Battle of 73 Easting, the largest tank battle since the Second World War, in which I participated and had a leading role. And the point is that throughout all of this, the key is how do you organize to fight and how do you exploit intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance and link that both to the striking power from the air and the sea, as well as forces on the ground. And it's an interesting journey. And then we look at what we may want to do in the future. And one of the things that I talk about in the conclusions is the criticality of understanding the importance of human capital, you know, having the best people that you can get in uniform, that have the best training and the best equipment, but also the best leadership, and how important it is to avoid conflict, but be prepared to fight it. In other words, if you don't have to fight, don't, so that if you are compelled to do so, you're prepared. We had that good fortune in 1991 when, for a change in our history, we actually were prepared, and I think the results speak for themselves.
Hmm. How about a quick comment about the Israeli battle that you were mentioning, 1973?
Well, the Israeli battle is very similar to the experience the Germans had, and I would argue that we had in 1991, and that is that the quality of the individual Israeli soldier, the ability of the Israeli soldier to think and act independently, which was true for the Germans during the Second World War and true for us in 1991, had a huge impact. As a result, the Israelis took far fewer casualties, although it was a very near-run thing. I mean, the Israelis, for the first time in their history, faced the real prospect of losing to a very large Arab force. And the Arabs demonstrated that they could actually fight. The Egyptians fought with great courage and fortitude, but the Egyptians did not have soldiers that could think independently. Neither, for the most part, did the Russians. The levels of education, literacy, training, experience, the cultural mentality wasn't there. And so this is back to the issue of human capital. You've got to get smart people, and smart people who can learn quickly and are then trained and accustomed to thinking on their own. It's a huge combat multiplier. It compensates for a lack of numbers.
Hmm. And just one last comment about your book. I'll just quote David Gray of the VMI, which I believe you studied there, Virginia Military Institute. Is that right?
I went to
West Point.
VMI for a year before I went to West Point. Yep.
Right. Here's what David Gray said about your book. The overarching thesis, or themes, rather, of Margin of Victory stress military preparedness and adaptability to the changing character of major wars, end quote. Okay, so now you and your battle experience, your army experience, you've seen a lot of situations where the borders are a very, very important issue. So why don't you comment on today's crisis in America, where we actually have the Democratic Party, many leaders in the Democratic Party are saying we need to abolish ICE. We need to, essentially open those borders and so forth. And it's inhumane to do anything less.
Well, first of all, a nation without borders is not a nation. And what has distinguished English-speaking North America from all of the states south of the Rio Grande, not just Mexico, has always been this culture that supports the rule of law. And that can't be overstated. When you have the rule of law, when individuals have specific individual rights and property rights, and they can do business in an environment that is not under threat from criminality and corruption, you can have a very prosperous and successful economy and a successful society. Those are the things that are absent in Mexico. And if you don't maintain a robust, defended border, when you border a country like Mexico that tragically has now really practically become, in fact, it really is an organized crime state, then you risk having that criminality spill into your country. And people carry that criminality, that corruption into the United States. They have no choice, or they can't move from where they are into the United States. So the problem of border defense and illegal immigration is absolutely inextricably intertwined. And as I was saying earlier, that's why we had the army on the border for so long. The problems that we're having with Mexico today are not really new. They've been with us almost from the inception, because Mexico has a very different history and development from ourselves. And we can't fix Mexico. Only the Mexicans can do that. But we also should not absorb the tragedy of Mexico in this country, or for that matter, now that it's spreading into Central America and down into parts of Northern South America. We are inviting the criminality and the corruption into the United States, to the point where we have many areas in the Southwest, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, that are frankly no longer United States territory. And we have millions. We have at least 30 million illegals. How many of those are Mexican or Hispanic is unknown, but it's certainly the majority. And vast numbers of these people, you mentioned DACA before, are not here to become part of the United States. They are here to claim it for themselves and, frankly, for Mexico. And it's a very dangerous proposition for the United States.
All right. What are your comments on the policy of separating families at the border? And by the way, I wrote about this in my weekly column in an article called Suffer the Little Children. And one of the things that just shocked me was a quote, a statistic rather, that I found, which said that 83% of the children that are captured, you know, in illegally trying to come to the country are not with a parent or a legal guardian. 83%. So the idea that the Trump administration was just trying to, you know, evilly, meanly, like the Grinch or something, separate families, children from their families, is hyperbole, you know, at best. But what are your comments about that issue? Because that certainly, you could see the humanitarian, the blow to the humanitarian side of things on that.
Well, first of all, we are not experiencing a migration or any form of immigration. What's happening and has been happening now for several years is large numbers of people are being assembled in Central America and Mexico. They are being organized and prepared to move north. It is a deliberate operation, and they have actually support and encouragement from figures inside the United States. So what we're dealing with is an invasion. Some people call it a soft invasion because these people are not necessarily marching into our country as part of an army, but they are, in fact, an army, and they're coming here for a very express purpose, and that is to change the demographic composition of the United States so that they can become voters and create a permanent dictatorship of the left in Washington. And unfortunately, we have large numbers of people in Washington on the left that think that this is a good idea, that this will allow them to establish a permanent grip on American society. And then there are others who are profiting in the private sector from the cheap labor. And there are still more who are simply at loss to understand. They don't understand that this is not a case of individuals who are leaving farms that have failed and coming north in search of a better life. This is a deliberate operation, a deliberate invasion, much like the Muslim invasion of Europe. That too falls into the same category. It's being very well organized and pushed with the goal of ultimately Islamicizing Europe. The only way to defend against this is to militarize your border, and that is to put the United States Army back on the border, and that's something the president should do. When he was told to put the National Guard there, it was very bad advice, because the National Guard is not really prepared for that kind of duty. We have thousands of veterans in the United States Army that have controlled borders in Afghanistan and Syria, Iraq. They know exactly how to do it, just as I did in Germany and others in Korea. We know how to control borders, and that's the first thing the president should have done once he was elected. Simply assign the mission to the regular army to secure the border and keep them there until such point in time as we have an effective barrier or barrier system.
All right. Hey, thank you. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Let me go ahead and give your website, douglasmcgregor.com. And again, the name of your book is Margin of Victory, Five Battles That Changed the Face of Modern War. Thanks for joining us. By the way, we do have time for like a squeeze in a last 15-second comment, if you want to, on this borders issue.
I think it's just important to understand that, again, a nation without borders, without a defined culture, without a national language will not long survive. We need to understand that.
All right. Thank you so much, Colonel McGregor. Appreciate your time. All the best.